If it's really necessary, we can have it out some other time. Right now, I'd just like to find out how all this came about. Put your sword away. When Seijuro had called him Gundyu, the young man had apparently not heard. Now, being addressed as Sasaki Kojiro startled him. How did you know who I am? He asked. Seijuro slapped his thigh. I knew it! I was only guessing, but I was right! Then he came forward and said, It's a pleasure to meet you. I've heard a good deal about you. Who from? Asked Kojiro. From your senior, Ito Yagoro. Oh, are you a friend of his? Yes. Until last fall, he had a hermitage on Kagura Hill in Shirakawa, and I often visited him there. He came to my house a number of times, too. Kojiro smiled. Well then, this is not exactly like meeting for the first time, is it? No. Ito-sai mentioned you rather often. He said there was a man from Iwakuni named Sasaki who had learned the style of Toda Seigen and then studied under Kanemaki Jisai. He told me this Sasaki was the youngest man in Jisai's school but would one day be the only swordsman who could challenge Ito-sai. I still don't see how you knew so quickly. Well, you're young, and you fit the description. Seeing you wield that long sword reminded me that you're also called Gundyu, the willow on the riverbank. I had a feeling it must be you, and I was right. That's amazing. It really is. As Kojiro chuckled with delight, his eyes dropped to his bloody sword, which reminded him that there had been a fight, and made him wonder how they would straighten everything out. As it happened, however, he and Seijuro hit it off so well that an understanding was soon reached, and after a few minutes they were walking along the dike shoulder to shoulder, like old friends. Behind them were Ryohei and the three dejected disciples. The little group headed toward Kyoto. Kojiro was saying, "From the beginning, I couldn't see what the fight was all about. I had nothing against them." Seijuro's thoughts were on Gion Toji's recent conduct. I'm disgusted with Toji, he said. When I get back, I'll call him to account. Please don't think I have any grudge against you. I'm simply mortified to find that the men in my school aren't better disciplined. Well, you can see what sort of man I am, Kojiro replied. I talk too big and I'm always ready to fight anybody. Your disciples weren't the only ones to blame. In fact, I think you should give them some credit for trying to defend your school's good name. It's unfortunate they're not much as fighters, but at least they tried. I feel a little sorry for them. I'm the one to blame, Seijuro said simply. The expression on his face was one of genuine pain. Let's just forget the whole thing. Nothing would please me more. The sight of the two making up came as a relief to the others. Who would have thought this handsome, overgrown boy was the great Sasaki Kojiro, whose praises Ito-sai had sung? The prodigy of Iwakuni were his actual words. No wonder Toji, in his ignorance, had been tempted to do some teasing, and no wonder he had ended up looking ridiculous. It made Ryohei and the other three shiver to think how close they had come to being mowed down by the drawing pole. Now that their eyes had been opened, the sight of Kojiro's broad shoulders and sturdy back made them wonder how they could have been so stupid as to underestimate him in the first place. After a time, they came again to the landing. The corpses were already frozen, and the three were assigned to bury them, while Ryohei went to find the horse. Kojiro went about whistling for his monkey, which suddenly appeared out of nowhere and jumped on his master's shoulder. Seijuro not only urged Kojiro to come along to the school on Shijo Avenue and stay a while, but even proffered his horse. Kojiro refused. That wouldn't be right, he said, with unaccustomed deference. I'm just a young ronin. And you're the master of a great school, the son of a distinguished man, the leader of hundreds of followers. Taking hold of the bridle, he continued, Please, you ride. I'll just hold on to this. It's easier to walk that way. If it's really all right for me to go with you, I'd like to accept your offer and stay with you in Kyoto for a time. Seijuro, with equal cordiality, said, Well then, I'll ride for now, and when your feet get tired, we can change places. Seijuro, faced with the certain prospect of having to fight Miyamoto Musashi at the beginning of the new year, was reflecting that it was not a bad idea to have a swordsman like Sasaki Kojiro around. Eagle Mountain. In the 1550s and 1560s, the most famous master swordsmen in eastern Japan were Tsukahara Bokuden and Lord Koizumi of Ise, whose rivals in central Honshu were Yoshioka Kenpo of Kyoto and Yagyu Muneyoshi of Yamato. In addition, there was Lord Kitabatake Tomonori of Kuwana, a master of the martial arts and an outstanding governor. Long after his death, the people of Kuwana spoke of him with affection, since to them he symbolized the essence of good government and prosperity. When Kitabatake studied under Bokuden, the latter passed on to him his supreme swordsmanship, his most secret of secret methods. Bokuden's son, Tsukahara Hikoshiro, inherited his father's name and estate, but had not been bequeathed his secret treasure. It was for this reason that Bokuden's style spread not in the east, where Hikoshiro was active, but in the Kuwana region, where Kitabatake ruled. Legend has it that after Bokuden's death, Hikoshiro came to Kuwana and tried to trick Kitabatake into revealing the secret method to him. "My father," he allegedly claimed, "long ago taught it to me, and I'm told he did the same with you. But lately I've been wondering whether what we were taught was in fact the same thing, since the ultimate secrets of the way are our mutual concern. I think we should compare what we've learned, don't you?" Though Kitabatake immediately realized Bokuden's heir was up to no good, he quickly agreed to a demonstration. But what Hikoshiro then became privy to was only the outward form of the supreme swordsmanship, not its innermost secret. As a result, Kitabatake remained the sole master of the true Bokuden style, and to learn it, students had to go to Kuwana. In the east, Hikoshiro passed on, as genuine, the spurious hollow shell of his father's skill, its form without its heart. Or such, in any case, was the story told to any traveler who happened to set foot in the Kuwana region. It was not a bad story, as such stories go, and being based on fact, it was both more plausible and less inconsequential than most of the myriad local folktales people told to reaffirm the uniqueness of their beloved towns and provinces. Musashi, descending Tarusuka Mountain on his way from the castle town of Kuwana, heard it from his groom. He nodded and said politely, "Really? How interesting." It was the middle of the last month of the year, and though the Ise climate is relatively warm, the wind blowing up into the pass from Nakko Inlet was cold and biting. He wore only a thin kimono, a cotton undergarment and a sleeveless cloak, clothing too light by any standard, and distinctly dirty as well. His face was not so much bronzed as blackened from exposure to the sun. Atop his weather-beaten head, his worn and frayed basket hat looked absurdly superfluous. Had he discarded it along the road, no one would have bothered to pick it up. His hair, which could not have been washed for many days, was tied in back but still managed to resemble a bird's nest. And whatever he had been doing for the past 6 months had left his skin looking like well-tanned leather. His eyes shone pearly white in their cold, dark setting. The groom had been worrying ever since he took on this unkempt rider. He doubted he would ever receive his pay and was certain he would see no return fare from their destination deep in the mountains.
"Sir," he said somewhat timidly.
"Hmm?"
"We'll reach Yokkaichi a little before noon and Kameyama by evening, but it'll be the middle of the night before we get to the village of Uji."
"Hmm.
Is that all right?"
"Hmm."
Musashi was more interested in the view of the inlet than in talking, and the groom, tried though he did, could elicit no more response than a nod and a non-committal, "Mmm." He tried again. "Uji's nothing but a little hamlet about 8 miles into the mountains from the ridge of Mount Suzuka. How do you happen to be going to a place like that?"
"I'm going to see someone."
"There's nobody there but a few farmers and woodcutters."
"In Kuwana, I heard there's a man there who's very good with the chain ball sickle."
"I guess that would be Shishido."
"That's the man. His name is Shishido something or other."
"Shishido Baiken?"
"Yes."
"He's a blacksmith, makes scythes. I remember hearing how good he is with that weapon. Are you studying the martial arts?"
"Hmm."
"Well, in that case, instead of going to see Baiken, I'd suggest you go to Matsuzaka. Some of the best swordsmen in Ise Province are there."
"Who, for instance?"
"Well, there's Mikogami Tenzen, for one."
Musashi nodded. "Yes, I've heard of him."
He said no more, leaving the impression that he was quite familiar with Mikogami's exploits. When they reached the little town of Yokkaichi, he limped painfully to a stall, ordered a box lunch, and sat down to eat. One of his feet was bandaged around the instep because of a festering wound on the sole, which explained why he had chosen to rent a horse rather than walk. Despite his usual habit of taking good care of his body, a few days earlier in the crowded port town of Narumi, he had stepped on a board with a nail in it. His red and swollen foot looked like a pickled persimmon, and since the day before, he had had a fever. To his way of thinking, he had had a battle with a nail, and the nail had won. As a student of the martial arts, he was humiliated at having let himself be taken unawares. "Is there no way to resist an enemy of this sort?" he asked himself several times. The nail was pointed upward and plainly visible. "I stepped on it because I was half asleep. No, blind, because my spirit is not yet active throughout my whole body. What's more, I let the nail penetrate deep. Proof, my reflexes are slow. If I'd been in perfect control, I would have noticed the nail as soon as the bottom of my sandal touched it." His trouble, he concluded, was immaturity. His body and his sword were still not one. Though his arms grew stronger every day, his spirit and the rest of his body were not in tune. It felt to him, in his self-critical frame of mind, like a crippling deformity. Still, he did not feel like he'd entirely wasted the past 6 months. After fleeing from Yagyu, he had gone first to Iga, then up the Omi High Road, then through the provinces of Mino and Owari. At every town, in every mountain ravine, he had sought to master the true way of the sword. At times he felt he had brushed up against it, but its secret remained elusive, something not to be found lurking in either town or ravine. He couldn't remember how many warriors he had clashed with. There had been dozens of them, all well-trained, superior swordsmen. It was not hard to find the able swordsmen. What was hard to find was a real man. While the world was full of people, all too full, finding a genuine human being was not easy. In his travels, Musashi had come to believe this very deeply, to the point of pain, and it discouraged him. But then his mind always turned to Takuan, for there, without doubt, was an authentic, unique individual. "I guess I'm lucky," thought Musashi. "At least I've had the good fortune to know one genuine man. I must make sure the experience of having known him bears fruit." Whenever Musashi thought of Takuan, a certain physical pain spread from his wrists throughout his body. It was a strange feeling, a physiological memory of the time when he had been bound fast to the Cryptomeria branch.
"Just wait," vowed Musashi. "One of these days, I'll tie Takuan up in that tree, and I'll sit on the ground and preach the true way of life to him."
It was not that he resented Takuan or had any desire for revenge. He simply wanted to show that the state of being one could attain through the way of the sword was higher than anyone could reach by practicing Zen. It made Musashi smile to think he might someday turn the tables on the eccentric monk. It could happen, of course, that things would not go exactly as planned, but supposing he did make great progress, and supposing he was eventually in a position to tie Takuan up in the tree and lecture him, what would Takuan be able to say then? Surely he would cry out for joy and proclaim, "It's magnificent! I'm happy now!" But no, Takuan would never be that direct. Being Takuan, he would laugh and say, "Stupid! You're improving, but you're still stupid." The actual words wouldn't really matter. The point was that Musashi felt, in a curious way, that hitting Takuan over the head with his personal superiority was something he owed to the monk, a kind of debt. The fantasy was innocent enough. Musashi had set out upon a way of his own and was discovering day by day how infinitely long and difficult the path to true humanity is. When the practical side of his nature reminded him of how much farther along that path Takuan was than he, the fantasy vanished. It unsettled him even more to consider how immature and inept he was compared to Sekishusei. Thinking of the old Yagyu master both maddened and saddened him, making him keenly aware of his own incompetence to speak of the way, the art of war, or anything else with any confidence. At times like this, the world, which he had once thought so full of stupid people, seemed frighteningly large. But then life, Musashi would tell himself, is not a matter of logic. The sword is not logic. What was important was not talk or speculation, but action. There may be other people much greater than he right now, but he, too, could be great. When self-doubt threatened to overwhelm him, it was Musashi's habit to make straight for the mountains, in whose seclusion he could live to himself. His style of life there was evident from his appearance on returning to civilization, his cheeks hollow as a deer's, his body covered with scratches and bruises, his hair dry and stiff from long hours under a cold waterfall. He would be so dirty from sleeping on the ground that the whiteness of his teeth seemed unearthly. But these were mere superficialities. Inside, he would be burning with a confidence, verging on arrogance and bursting with eagerness to take on a worthy adversary. And it was this search for a test of mettle that always brought him down from the mountains. He was on the road now because he wondered whether the chain ball sickle expert of Kuwana might do. In the 10 days left before his appointment in Kyoto, he had time to go and find out whether Shishido Baiken was that rare entity a real man, or just another of the multitude of rice-eating worms who inhabit the earth. It was late at night before he reached his destination deep in the mountains. After thanking the groom, he told him he was free to leave, but the groom said that since it was so late, he would prefer to accompany Musashi to the house he was looking for and spend the night under the eaves. The next morning he could go down from Suzuka Pass and, if he was lucky, pick up a return fare on the way. Anyhow, it was too cold and dark to try making his way back before sunup. Musashi sympathized with him. They were in a valley enclosed on three sides, and any way the groom went, he'd have to climb the mountains knee-deep in snow. "In that case," said Musashi, "come with me."
"To Shishido Baiken's house?"
"Yes."
"Thank you, sir.
Let's see if we can find it. Since Baikeng ran a smithy, any of the local farmers would have been able to direct them to his place, but at this hour of the night, the whole village was in bed. The only sign of life was the steady thud of a mallet beating on a fulling block. Walking through the frigid air toward the sound, they eventually spied a light. It turned out to be the blacksmith's house. In front was a pile of old metal, and the underside of the eaves was smoke-stained. At Musashi's command, the groom pushed open the door and went in. There was a fire in the forge, and a woman with her back to the flames was pounding cloth.
"Good evening, ma'am. Oh, you've got a fire. That's wonderful."
The groom made straight for the forge. The woman jumped at the sudden intrusion and dropped her work.
"Who in the world are you?"
she asked.
"Just a moment, I'll explain," he said, warming his hands. "I've brought a man from a long way off who wants to meet your husband. We just got here. I'm a groom from Kuana."
"Well, of all..."
The woman looked sourly in Musashi's direction. The frown on her face made it evident that she had seen more than enough shugyosha and had learned how to handle them. With a touch of arrogance, she said to him, as though to a child,
"Shut the door! The baby will catch cold with all that freezing air blowing in."
Musashi bowed and complied. Then, taking a seat on a tree stump beside the forge, he surveyed his surroundings, from the blackened foundry area to the three-room living space. On a board nailed to one section of the wall hung about 10 chainball sickle weapons. He assumed that was what they were, since, if the truth be told, he'd never laid eyes on the device. As a matter of fact, another reason for his having made the journey here was that he thought a student like himself should become acquainted with every type of weapon. His eyes sparkled with curiosity. The woman, who was about 30 and rather pretty, put down her mallet and went back into the living area. Musashi thought perhaps she would bring some tea, but instead she went to a mat where a small child was sleeping, picked him up and began to suckle him. To Musashi, she said,
"I suppose you're one of those young samurai who come here to get bloodied up by my husband. If you are, you're in luck. He's off on a trip, so you don't have to worry about getting killed."
She laughed merrily. Musashi did not laugh with her. He was thoroughly annoyed. He had not come to this out-of-the-way village to be made fun of by a woman, all of whom, he mused, tended to overestimate their husband's status absurdly. This wife was worse than most. She seemed to think her spouse the greatest man on earth. Not wanting to give offense, Musashi said, "I'm disappointed to learn that your husband's away. Where did he go?"
"To the Arakida house."
"Where's that?"
"Ah, you've come to Ise and you don't even know the Arakida family?"
The baby at her breast began to fret, and the woman, forgetting about her guests, started to sing a lullaby in the local dialect.
"Go to sleep, go to sleep. Sleeping babies are sweet. Babies who wake and cry are naughty, and they make their mothers cry too."
Thinking he might at least learn something by taking a look at the blacksmith's weapons, Musashi asked, "Are those the weapons your husband wields so well?" The woman grunted, and when he asked to examine them, she nodded and grunted again. He took one down from its hook. "So this is what they're like," he said, half to himself. "I've heard people are using them a good deal these days." The weapon in his hand consisted of a metal bar about a foot and a half long, easily carried in one's obi, with a ring at one end to which a long chain was attached. At the other end of the chain was a heavy metal ball, quite substantial enough to crack a person's skull. In a deep groove on one side of the bar, Musashi could see the back of a blade. As he pulled at it with his fingernails, it snapped out sideways like the blade of a sickle. With this, it would be a simple matter to cut off an opponent's head.
"I suppose you hold it like this," said Musashi,
taking the sickle in his left hand and the chain in his right. Imagining an enemy in front of him, he assumed a stance and considered what movements would be necessary. The woman, who had turned her eyes from the baby's bed to watch, chided him. "Not that way! That's terrible!" Stuffing her breast back in her kimono, she came over to where he was standing. "If you do that, anyone with a sword can cut you down with no trouble at all. Hold it this way." She snatched the weapon from his hands and showed him how to stand. It made him queasy to see a woman take a battle stance with such a brutal-looking weapon. He stared with open mouth. While nursing the baby, she had appeared distinctly bovine, but now, ready for combat, she looked handsome, dignified, and yes, beautiful. As Musashi watched, he saw that on the blade, which was blackish-blue like the back of a mackerel, there was an inscription reading, "Style of Shishido Yaegaki." She kept the stance only momentarily. "Well, anyway, it's something like that," she said, folding the blade back into the handle and hanging the weapon on its hook. Musashi would have liked to see her handle the device again, but she obviously had no intention of doing so. After clearing up the fulling block, she clattered about near the sink, evidently washing pots or preparing to cook something. "If this woman can take a stance as imposing as that," thought Musashi, "her husband must really be something to see." By this time, he was nearly sick with the desire to meet Baikang, and quietly asked the groom about the Arakidas. The groom, leaning against the wall and baking in the warmth of the fire, mumbled that they were the family charged with guarding Ise Shrine. If this was true, Musashi thought, they would not be difficult to locate. He resolved to do just that, then curled up on a mat by the fire and went to sleep. In the early morning, the blacksmith's apprentice got up and opened the outside door to the smithy. Musashi got up too and asked the groom to take him to Yamada, the town nearest Ise Shrine. The groom, satisfied because he'd been paid the day before, agreed at once. By evening they had reached the long, tree-lined road that led to the shrine. The tea shops looked particularly desolate, even for winter. There were few travelers, and the road itself was in poor condition. A number of trees blown down by autumn storms were still lying where they had fallen. From the inn in Yamada, Musashi sent a servant to inquire at the Arakida house whether Shishido Baiken was staying there. A reply came saying that there must be some mistake. No one of that name was there. In his disappointment, Musashi turned his attention to his injured foot, which had swollen up considerably overnight. He was exasperated, for only a few days remained before he was due in Kyoto. In the letter of challenge he had sent to the Yoshioka school from Nagoya, he had given them the choice of any day during the first week of the new year. He couldn't very well beg off now because of a sore foot, and besides, he had promised to meet Matahachi at the Gojo Avenue Bridge. He spent the whole of the next day applying a remedy he had once heard about. Taking the dregs left after making bean curd, he put them in a cloth sack, squeezed the warm water out, and soaked his foot in it. Nothing happened, and to make matters worse, the smell of the bean curd was nauseating. As he fretted over his foot, he bemoaned his stupidity in making this detour to Ise. He should have gone to Kyoto straight away. That night, with his foot wrapped up under the quilt, his fever shot higher, and the pain became unendurable. The next morning, he desperately tried more prescriptions, including smearing on some oily medicine given him by the innkeeper, who swore his family had used it for generations. Still, the swelling did not go down. The foot began to look to Musashi like a large, bloated wad of bean curd and felt as heavy as a block of wood. The experience set him to thinking. He had never in his life been bedridden for 3 days. Aside from having a carbuncle on his head as a child, he couldn't remember ever having been ill. "Sickness is the worst kind of enemy," he reflected. "Yet I'm powerless in its grip. Until now, he had assumed his adversaries would be coming at him from without, and the fact of being immobilized by a foe within was both novel and thought-provoking. How many more days are there in the year? He wondered. I can't just stay here doing nothing. As he lay there chafing, his ribs seemed to press in on his heart, and his chest felt constricted. He kicked the quilt off his swollen foot. If I can't even beat this, how can I hope to overcome the whole house of Yoshioka? Thinking he would pin down and stifle the demon inside him, he forced himself to sit on his haunches in formal style. It was painful, excruciatingly so. He nearly fainted. He faced the window but closed his eyes, and quite some time passed before the violent redness in his face began to subside and his head to cool a bit. He wondered if the demon was yielding to his unflinching tenacity. Opening his eyes, he saw before him the forest around Ise Shrine. Beyond the trees, he could see Mount Mae, and a little to the east, Mount Asama. Rising above the mountains between these two was a soaring peak that looked down its nose at its neighbors and stared insolently at Musashi. It's an eagle, he thought, not knowing its name actually was Eagle Mountain. The peak's arrogant appearance offended him. Its haughty pose taunted him until his fighting spirit was once again stirred. He could not help thinking of Yagyu Sekishusai, the old swordsman who resembled this proud peak, and as time passed, it began to seem the peak was Sekishusai, looking down at him from above the clouds and laughing at his weakness and insignificance. Staring at the mountain, he became for a time oblivious of his foot, but presently the pain reasserted its claim on his consciousness. Had he rammed his leg into the fire of the blacksmith's forge, it couldn't have hurt any more, he thought bitterly. Involuntarily, he drew the big round thing out from under him and glared at it, unable to accept the fact that it was really a part of him. In a loud voice, he summoned the maid. When she did not appear promptly, he beat on the tatami with his fist. "Where is everybody?" he shouted. "I'm leaving! Bring the bill! Fix me some food, some fried rice, and get me 3 pairs of heavy straw sandals." Soon he was out on the street, limping through the old marketplace, where the famous warrior Tairano Tadakiyo, the hero of the Story of the Hōgen War, was supposed to have been born. But now little about it suggested a birthplace of heroes. It was more like an open-air brothel, lined with tea stalls and teeming with women. More temptresses than trees stood along the lane, calling out to travelers and latching on to the sleeves of passing prospects as they flirted, coaxed, and teased. To get to the shrine, Musashi had to literally push his way through them, scowling and avoiding their impertinent stares.
"What happened to your foot? Shall I make it feel better? Here, let me rub it for you."
They pulled at his clothing, grabbed at his hands, grasped his wrists.
"A good-looking man won't get anywhere frowning like that."
Musashi reddened and stumbled along blindly. Utterly without defense against this kind of attack, he apologized to some and made polite excuses to others, which only made the women titter. When one of them said he was as cute as a baby panther, the assault of the whitened hands intensified. Finally, he gave up all pretense of dignity and ran, not even stopping to retrieve his hat when it flew off. The giggling voices followed him through the trees outside the town. It was impossible for Musashi to ignore women, and the frenzy their pawing hands aroused in him took long to subside. The mere memory of the scent of pungent white powder would set his pulse racing, and no amount of mental effort could calm it. It was a greater threat than an enemy standing with sword drawn before him. He simply did not know how to cope with it. Later, his body burning with sexual fire, he would toss and turn all night. Even innocent Otsu sometimes became the object of his lustful fantasies. Today he had his foot to take his mind off the women, but running from them when he was barely able to walk, he might as well have been crossing a bed of molten metal. At every other step, a stab of anguish shot to his head from the sole of his foot. His lips reddened, his hands grew as sticky as honey, and his hair smelled acrid from sweat. Just lifting the injured foot took all the strength he could muster. At times he felt as if his body would suddenly fall apart. Not that he had any illusions. He knew when he left the inn that this would be torture, and he intended to survive it. Somehow he managed to stay in control, cursing under his breath each time he dragged the wretched foot forward. Crossing the Isuzu River and entering the precincts of the inner shrine brought a welcome change of atmosphere. He sensed a sacred presence, sensed it in the plants, in the trees, even in the voices of the birds. What it was, he could not say, but it was there. He groaned and collapsed on the roots of a great cryptomeria, whimpering softly with pain and holding his foot in both hands. For a long time he sat there, motionless as a rock, his body aflame with fever, even as his skin was bitten by the cold wind. Why had he suddenly risen from his bed and fled the inn? Any normal person would have stayed there quietly until the foot healed. Was it not childish, even imbecilic, for an adult to allow impatience to overcome him? But it was not impatience only that had moved him. It was a spiritual need, and a very deep one. For all the pain, all the physical torment, his spirit was tense and throbbing with vitality. He lifted his head and with keen eyes regarded the nothingness around him. Through the bleak, ceaseless moaning of the great trees in the sacred forest, Musashi's ear caught another sound. Somewhere, not far away, flutes and reeds were giving voice to the strains of ancient music, music dedicated to the gods, while ethereal children's voices sang a holy invocation. Drawn by this peaceful sound, Musashi tried to stand. Biting his lips, he forced himself up, his unwilling body resisting every move. Reaching the dirt wall of a shrine building, he grasped it with both hands and worked his way along with an awkward, crab-like movement. The heavenly music was coming from a building a little farther on, where a light shone through a latticed window. This, the House of Virgins, was occupied by young girls in the service of the deity. Here they practiced playing ancient musical instruments and learned to perform sacred dances devised centuries earlier. Musashi made his way to the rear entrance of the building. He paused and looked in, but saw no one. Relieved at not having to explain himself, he removed his swords and the pack on his back, tied them together, and hung them on a peg on the inside wall. Thus unencumbered, he put his hands on his hips and began hobbling back toward the Isuzu River. An hour or so later, completely naked, he broke the ice on the surface and plunged into the frigid waters. And there he stayed, splashing and bathing, dunking his head, purifying himself. Fortunately, no one was about. Any passing priest would have thought him insane and driven him away. According to Ise legend, an archer named Nikki Yoshinaga had, long ago, attacked and occupied a part of the Ise Shrine territory. Once ensconced, he fished in the sacred Isuzu River and used falcons to catch small birds in the sacred forest. In the course of these sacrilegious plunderings, the legend said, he went totally insane, and Musashi, acting as he was, could easily have been taken for the madman's ghost. When finally he leapt onto a boulder, it was with the lightness of a small bird. While he was drying himself and putting on his clothes, the strands of hair along his forehead stiffened into slivers of ice. To Musashi, the icy plunge into the sacred stream was necessary. If his body could not withstand the cold, How could it survive in the face of life's more threatening obstacles? And at this moment, it was not a matter of some abstract future contingency, but one of taking on the very real Yoshioka Seijuro and his entire school. They would hurl every bit of strength they had at him. They had to save face. They knew they had no alternative but to kill him, and Musashi knew just saving his skin was going to be tricky. Faced with this prospect, the typical samurai would invariably talk about fighting with all his might, or being prepared to face death. But to Musashi's way of thinking, this was a lot of nonsense. To fight a life-or-death struggle with all one's might was no more than animal instinct. Moreover, while not being thrown off balance by the prospect of death was a mental state of a higher order, it was not really so difficult to face death if one knew that one had to die. Musashi was not afraid to die, but his objective was to win definitively, not just survive, and he was trying to build up the confidence to do so. Let others die heroic deaths, if that suited them. Musashi could settle for nothing less than a heroic victory. Kyoto was not far away, no more than 70 or 80 miles. If he could keep up a good pace, he could get there in 3 days. But the time needed to prepare himself spiritually was beyond measuring. Was he inwardly ready? Were his mind and spirit truly one? Musashi wasn't yet able to reply to these questions in the affirmative. He felt that somewhere deep inside himself there was a weakness, the knowledge of his immaturity. He was painfully aware that he had not attained the state of mind of the true master, that he was still far short of being a complete and perfect human. When he compared himself with Nikkan, or Sekishusai, or Takuan, he could not avoid the simple truth. He was still green. His own analysis of his abilities and traits unveiled not only weaknesses in some areas, but virtual blind spots in others. But unless he could triumph throughout this life and leave an indelible mark on the world around him, he could not regard himself as a master of the art of war. His body shook as he shouted, "I will win! I will!" Limping on toward the upper reaches of the Isuzu, he cried out again for all the trees in the sacred forest to hear, "I will win!" He passed a silent, frozen waterfall and, like a primitive man, crawled over the boulders and pushed his way through the thick groves and deep ravines where few had ever gone before. His face was as red as a demon's. Clinging to rocks and vines, he could, with the utmost effort, advance only one step at a time. Beyond a point called Ichinose, there was a gorge 500 or 600 yards long, so full of crags and rapids that even the trout could not make their way through it. At the far end rose an almost sheer precipice. It was said that only monkeys and goblins could climb it. Musashi merely looked at the cliff and said matter-of-factly, "This is it. This is the way to Eagle Mountain." Elated, he saw no impassable barrier here. Seizing hold of strong vines, he started up the rock face, half-climbing, half-swinging, seemingly lifted by some upside-down gravity. Having reached the cliff top, he exploded with a cry of triumph. From here, he could make out the white flow of the river and the silver strand along the shore of Futamigaura. Ahead of him, through a sparse grove veiled in nocturnal mist, he saw before his eyes the foot of Eagle Mountain. The mountain was Sekishusai. As it had laughed while he'd lain in bed, the peak continued to mock him now. His unyielding spirit felt literally assaulted by Sekishusai's superiority. It was oppressing him, holding him back. Gradually, his objective took form. To climb to the top and unleash his rancor. To trample roughshod on the head of Sekishusai, to show him Musashi could and would win. He advanced against the opposition of weeds, trees, ice, all enemies trying desperately to keep him back. Every step, every breath was a challenge. His recently chilled blood boiled, and his body steamed as the sweat from his pores met the frosty air. Musashi hugged the red surface of the peak, groping for footholds. Each time he felt for a footing, he had to struggle, and small rocks would go crashing down to the grove below. 100 feet, 200, 300. He was in the clouds. When they parted, he appeared from below to be hanging weightless in the sky. The mountain peak stared coldly down at him. Now, nearing the top, he hung on for dear life. One false move and he would come flying down in a cascade of rocks and boulders. He puffed and grunted, gasping for air with his very pores. So intense was the strain, his heart seemed about to rise up and explode from his mouth. He could climb but a few feet, then rest, climb a few feet more, then rest again. The whole world lay beneath him. The great forest enclosing the shrine, the white strip that must be the river. Mount Asama, Mount Mae, the fishing village at Toba, the great open sea. Almost there, he thought. Just a little more. Just a little more. How easy to say, but how difficult to achieve. For just a little more is what distinguishes the victorious sword from the vanquished. The odor of sweat in his nostrils, he felt giddily that he was nestled in his mother's breast. The rough surface of the mountain began to feel like her skin, and he experienced an urge to go to sleep. But just then, a piece of rock under his big toe broke off and brought him to his senses. He groped for another foothold. This is it. I'm almost there. Hands and feet knotted with pain, he clawed again at the mountain. If his body or willpower weakened, he told himself, then as a swordsman he would surely one day be done in. This was where the match would be decided, and Musashi knew it. This is for you, Six Shusai, you bastard! With every pull and tug, he execrated the giants he respected, those supermen who had brought him here and whom he must and would conquer. One for you, Nikkang, and you, Takua! He was climbing over the heads of his idols, trampling over them, showing them who was best. He and the mountain were now one. But the mountain, as if astonished to have this creature clawing into it, snarled and spit out regular avalanches of gravel and sand. Musashi's breath stopped as though someone had clapped his hands over his face. As he clung to the rock, the wind gusted, threatening to blow him away, rock and all. Then suddenly he was lying on his stomach, his eyes closed, not daring to move. But in his heart he sang a song of exultation. At the moment when he had flattened out, he had seen the sky in all directions, and the light of dawn was suddenly visible in the white sea of clouds below. I've done it. I've won. The instant he realized he had reached the top, his strained willpower snapped like a bowstring. The wind at the summit showered his back with sand and stones. Here at the border of heaven and earth, Musashi felt an indescribable joy swelling out to fill his whole being. His sweat-drenched body united with the surface of the mountain. The spirit of man and the spirit of the mountain were performing the great work of procreation in the vast expanse of nature at dawn. Wrapped in an unearthly ecstasy, he slept the sleep of peace. When he finally lifted his head, his mind was as pure and clear as crystal. He had the impulse to jump and dart about like a minnow in a stream. "There's nothing above me," he cried. "I'm standing on top of the eagle's head." The pristine morning sun cast its reddish light on him and on the mountain as he stretched his brawny, savage arms toward the sky. He looked down at his 2 feet planted firmly on the summit, and as he looked, he saw what seemed like a bucketful of yellowish pus stream from his injured foot. Amid the celestial purity surrounding him, there arose the strange odor of humanity, the sweet smell of gloom dispelled. The Mayfly in Winter. Every morning after finishing their shrine duties, the maidens living in the House of Virgins went, books in hand, to the schoolroom at the Arakida House, where they studied grammar and practiced writing poems. For their performances of religious dances, they dressed in white silk kimono with crimson, widely flared trousers called hakama. But now they had on the short-sleeved kimono and white cotton hakama they wore while studying or doing household chores. A group of them was streaming out the back door when one exclaimed, "What's that?" She was pointing to the pack with the swords tied to it, hung up there by Musashi the night before. "Whose do you think it is? It must be a samurai's. Isn't that obvious?" "No, it could have been left here by a thief." They looked wide-eyed at each other and gulped, as though they had come across the robber himself, leather-bandanaed and taking his noonday nap. "Perhaps we should tell Otsu about it," one of them suggested, and by common consent they all ran back to the dormitory and called up from beneath the railing outside Otsu's room. "Sensei! Sensei! There's something strange down here. Come and look!" Otsu put her writing brush down on her desk and stuck her head out the window. "What is it?" she asked. "A thief left his swords and a bundle behind. They're over there, hanging on the back wall." "Really? You'd better take them over to the Arakida House." "Oh, we can't. We're afraid to touch them." "Aren't you making a big fuss over nothing? Run along to your lessons now and don't waste any more time." By the time Otsu came down from her room, the girls had gone. The only people in the dormitory were the old woman who did the cooking and one of the maidens who had taken ill. "Whose things are those hanging up here?" Otsu asked the cook. The woman did not know, of course. "I'll take them over to the Arakida House," Otsu said. When she took the pack and swords down, she nearly dropped them. They were so heavy. Lugging them with both hands, she wondered how men could walk about carrying so much weight. Otsu and Jotaro had come here 2 months earlier, after traveling up and down the Iga, Omi, and Mino high roads in search of Musashi. Upon their arrival in Ise, they had decided to settle down for the winter, since it would be difficult to make their way through the mountains in the snow. At first, Otsu had given flute lessons in the Toba district, but then she had come to the attention of the head of the Arakida family who, being the official ritualist, ranked second only to the chief priest. When Arakida asked Otsu to come to the shrine to teach the maidens, she had consented, not so much out of a desire to teach as out of her interest in learning the ancient sacred music. Then, too, the peacefulness of the shrine's forest had appealed to her, as had the idea of living for a while with the shrine maidens, the youngest of whom was 13 or 14, and the oldest around 20. Jotaro had stood in the way of her taking the position, for it was forbidden to have a male, even of his age, living in the same dormitory as the maidens. The arrangement they arrived at was that Jotaro could sweep the sacred gardens in the daytime and spend his nights in the Arakida's woodshed. As Otsu passed through the shrine gardens, a forbidding, unearthly breeze whistled through the leafless trees. One thin column of smoke rose from a distant grove, and Otsu thought of Jotaro, who was probably there cleaning the grounds with his bamboo broom. She stopped and smiled, pleased that Jotaro, the incorrigible, was minding very well these days, applying himself dutifully to his chores at just the age when young boys think of nothing but playing and amusing themselves. The loud cracking noise she heard sounded like a branch breaking off a tree. It came a second time, and clutching her load, she ran down the path through the grove, calling, "Jotaro! Jotaro!"
Yes?
Came the lusty reply. In no time she heard his running footsteps. But when he drew up before her, he said merely,
Oh, it's you.
I thought you were supposed to be working,
said Otsu sternly.
What are you doing with that wooden sword, and dressed in your white work clothes, too?
I was practicing. Practicing on the trees.
Nobody objects to your practicing, but not here, Jotaro. Have you forgotten where you are? This garden symbolizes peace and purity. It's a holy area, sacred to the goddess who is the ancestress of us all. Look over there. Don't you see the sign saying it's forbidden to damage the trees or hurt or kill the animals? It's a disgrace for a person who works here to be breaking off branches with a wooden sword.
Ah, I know all that, he grumbled, a look of resentment on his face.
If you know it, why do you do it? If Master Arakida caught you at it, you'd really be in trouble.
I don't see anything wrong with breaking off dead limbs. It's all right if they're dead, isn't it?
No, it is not. Not here.
That's how much you know. Just let me ask you a question.
What might that be?
If this garden is so important, why don't people take better care of it?
It's a shame they don't. To let it run down this way is like letting weeds grow in one's soul.
It wouldn't be so bad if it were only weeds, but look at the trees.
The ones split by lightning have been allowed to die, and the ones blown over by the typhoons are lying right where they fell.
They're all over the place, and the birds have pecked at the roofs of the buildings until they leak, and nobody ever fixes any of the stone lanterns when they get knocked out of shape. How can you think this place is important?
Listen, Otsu, isn't the castle at Osaka white and dazzling when you see it from the ocean at Setsu? Isn't Tokugawa Ieyasu building more magnificent castles at Fushimi and a dozen other places? Aren't the new houses of the daimyo and the rich merchants in Kyoto and Osaka glittering with gold ornaments? Don't the tea masters Rikyu and Kobori Enshu say that even a speck of dirt out of place in the tea house garden spoils the flavor of the tea? But this garden's going to ruin. Why, the only people working in it are me and three or four old men. And look how big it is.
Jotaro, said Otsu, putting her hand under his chin and lifting his face. You're doing nothing but repeating word for word what Master Arakida said in a lecture.
Oh, did you hear it too?
Indeed, I did, she said reproachfully.
Well, can't win all the time.
Parroting what Master Arakida says will carry no weight with me. I don't approve of it, even when what he says is right.
He is right, you know. When I hear him talk, I wonder whether Nobunaga and Hideyoshi and Ieyasu are really such great men. I know they're supposed to be important, but is it really so wonderful to take control of the country if you get the idea that you're the only person in it who counts?
Well, Nobunaga and Hideyoshi weren't as bad as some of the others. At least they repaired the imperial palace in Kyoto and tried to make the people happy, even if they did these things only to justify their conduct to themselves and others, they still deserve a lot of credit. The Ashikaga shoguns were much worse.
How?
You've heard about the Onin War, haven't you? The Ashikaga shogunate was so incompetent, there was constant civil war. Warriors fighting other warriors all the time to gain more territory for themselves. The ordinary people didn't get a moment's peace, and nobody had any real concern for the country as a whole.
You mean those famous battles between the Yamanas and the Hosokawas?
Yes. It was during those days, over 100 years ago, that Arakida Ujitsune became the chief priest of the Ise Shrine, and there wasn't even enough money to continue the ancient ceremonies and sacred rites. Ujitsune petitioned the government 27 times for help to repair the shrine buildings, but the imperial court was too poor, the shogunate was too weak, and the warriors so busy with their bloodbaths they didn't care what happened. In spite of all this, Ujitsune went around pleading his case till he finally succeeded in setting up a new shrine. It's a sad story, isn't it?
But when you think about it, people, when they grow up, forget they owe their lifeblood to their ancestors, just as we all owe our lives to the goddess at Ise.